Morning Summit in Wasatch County's 8:06 on your Thursday morning. It's September 9th. I'm Sean Higgins, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher today. Currently 52 degrees in Park City. Looking at 43 down in here, but on the line with me right now with a full forecast at the ABC Forecast Center, I have meteorologist Thomas Gaboy. Good morning, Thomas.
Well, good morning to you, and happy Thursday or happy Friday Eve. Really closing in on the weekend, and our weather as we turn towards the weekend, we'll see some changes, but for today, it's going to be more warmth and it's going to be more patchy smoke as well. In Park City, the daytime high around 86 degrees this afternoon. It'll be mostly sunny along with the smoke, but the air quality continues to remain not so great. Our winds, though, they're starting to switch more out of the south. So that might be able to help out with the smoke a little bit as we move from the latter half of today into tonight, as temperatures tonight eventually drop into the upper 50s to around 60 degrees. For tomorrow, we're going to get partly sunny skies. Thanks to that moisture working its way in, there's also a system approaching from the west that's currently working its way towards California. And by tomorrow, with that moisture that we have, we could see a few showers, maybe a few thunderstorms. If we get some thunderstorms, then keep in mind we could see some gusty winds from that. It's about a 1 in 3 chance for a shower or thunderstorm once we get past noon tomorrow. And then we'll continue to keep a slight chance for showers and thunderstorms in the forecast through Friday night through Saturday as well. So for tomorrow night, it's about a 50-50 chance. And for your Saturday, it's about a 2 in 3 chance that we could find some rain. It's not a guarantee that we're going to find some, but that's definitely going to be our best chance, will be from late Friday through Saturday. And the temperatures will also start to come down a little bit as well. On Friday, the high temperature in the lower 80s. Overnight lows on Friday night and the Saturday morning, middle 50s. Then for Saturday, the daytime high will be in the lower and middle 70s. So quite a change of pace compared to where we're going to be for today. Keeping a slim rain chance in the forecast through Saturday night, about a 20% rain chance. Looking at a mostly sunny sky heading into Sunday with high temperatures in the middle 70s. We could see another round of light showers, maybe a rumble of thunder Sunday night into Monday. But the trend through the early stages of next week will be the moisture moving away. So we'll be going back to predominantly dry skies by your Tuesday. But temperatures will kind of hover near seasonal averages in the lower to middle 70s. And overnight lows will kind of hover around 50 degrees starting Monday night, lasting through the middle stages of the week.
Thomas, sounds great. Thank you so much. Enjoy your day.
You're welcome. And you too.
Taking a look at some local news now. Due to rising numbers of COVID-19 cases in the area, the organizers and sponsors of the annual Shot Ski have canceled the event, but plan to return next year. KPZW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
Park City's Shot Ski has been in a friendly rivalry for the world record for most participants with Breckenridge Resort for years. In 2019, the last time the event was held in Park City, more than 1,300 people stood before 515 skis bolted together into a 2,600-foot-long ski with shot glasses on top. The event and another attempt at a world record was scheduled to happen on Saturday, October 9th on Park City's Main Street. Park City Sunrise Rotary Club member Lola Beetlebrock says that they've been looking forward to it since the 2020 Shot Ski was canceled last year.
Well, of course, the Park City Sunrise Rotary is really sad as a board to have to cancel this big event that is our major fundraiser for the year. And we respect High West's decision. It really is best for the community because of the health issues that are involved in having 3,000 people all gather together and enjoy a day on Main Street and raising money for the nonprofits of this community. But because of the high COVID risk right now, we had to make that decision.
The event, which usually raises about $30,000 to be distributed to area nonprofits, isn't a total loss. Beetlebrock says that the event sponsor, High West Distillery, is donating the $10,000 that it would have cost the company to put on the event.
And so we are very grateful for this gift, and it will substantially support our grants program, and we will have another fundraiser.
Beetlebrock says the Rotary Club is looking at holding a chili cook-off with High West next spring and will hopefully bring back Shot Ski in October 2022. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
Well, access to quality child care is in a crisis, according to policy experts. They're worried that children whose parents can't afford quality daycare will be left behind. In the second installment of the two-part series, Carolyn Murray reports on solutions that visiting author Elliot Haspel has for building a more robust, all-inclusive childcare system in the United States.
Policy expert and author Elliot Haspel said finding enough providers to staff childcare facilities was hard before COVID-19, And the pandemic made things worse as people left the workforce to care for family members during the shutdown. Haspel recently presented research from his book, Crawling Behind: America's Childcare Crisis, to local stakeholders. He outlined problems with wage disparity, suggesting providers need better pay and benefits to respond to what he calls a growing crisis.
In Utah, according to the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment out of UC Berkeley, the median wage for a childcare worker in Utah is $10.47, which means half of them are making less. You know, when you have that level of compensation going on, other kind of low-wage industries in the service and retail, right, McDonald's is raising their wages, Amazon and Target are up to a $15 starting wage. They're offering benefits. I think, ironically, some of them are offering childcare benefits as a way to sort of incentivize workers. It's really, really hard for childcare programs to compete. Childcare programs can't just raise their prices. Parents can't pay any more.
Haspel said the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill currently in Congress has excellent potential to address staffing pay standards and the need for professional training opportunities for providers. His work supports using federal funds to expand outreach to all socioeconomic communities. He said local innovation and resources are essential because every community has different childcare needs.
Have these local organizations who understand the needs of their local populations and are already sort of working on innovating ways to reach those families, to provide them what they're going to need. That's really essential. So being able to, you know, also support the work of the local infrastructure. And then the other thing is the local advocacy. So being able to talk with local elected officials, statewide elected officials, and eventually with federal, you know, elected officials, and this sort of two-way dialogue so that they're actually passing policy that will, when it comes back down to the local level, work. What we wouldn't want to see happen is all this money come and then it actually not be implemented effectively.
Haspel said there are things to learn from the antiquated public education system in the U.S. He believes the government should fund early childcare and education, but not necessarily run the programs.
Parents can access care delivered through public means, a Head Start program, a public pre-K program, or through private means, through something from a faith community, a family that opens their home and has a business to take children in. Even though our U.S. public education system tracks back to Thomas Jefferson and, you know, the 18th century, the fact is we can learn from a lot of what's good about that, which is that everyone, regardless of income, can access it. They have a spot. There's no worry about that. And we can also learn from what doesn't work well in the public education system, the sort of overstandardization, the inequities along socioeconomic and racial lines.
He believes a system based on parent choice would dispel any concerns about government's role in social programs. Haspel also said society is changing its mindset about the importance of early childhood education and the critical role in defining a child's later success. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, the Summit County Council met in a regular meeting yesterday, and on the line with me now with a recap is County Council Member Doug Klei. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning.
So let's jump into it. The big major item for County Council was deciding on a policy about accessory buildings in the basin. These are controversial because of criticisms that some owners are putting up too many small buildings or that they're putting up big arena-like buildings. The county's temporary zoning ordinance halting new application actually expires tomorrow. What did the council decide here?
We basically adopted a series of revisions that were forwarded to us by the Planning Commission. We had a couple of options with some minor differences between the two in terms of size of building and actual height, etc. And by a 3-2 vote, we elected to adopt the recommendations of the Planning Commission.
And does this policy have a sunset clause as well?
No, this one did not. No.
We heard Chris Robinson argue strongly against what he says is a one-size-fits-all solution to this problem. He said restricting buildings or their size doesn't work on a relatively big lot, and he would prefer a sliding scale system. But you disagreed with that approach. Why is that?
It's a very complicated issue, but the answer is that it does. It just depends on your perspective. Chris brings a very strong property rights point of view to the discussion. He was clear on that. It's not a point that is lost on us. But government's job is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of everyone. And when it comes to zoning, that's a welfare question, and that's complicated stuff. You know, are you better off if your neighbor is allowed to build a huge industrial like looking building next to you, or are you better off if you restrict that use? And I think there is growing concern that those uses are largely out of control, or not largely out of control, but partially out of control. And most importantly, that that we could end up with a plethora of those uses, and they could get grandfathered in. It would be impossible for us to change if we don't put some controls on it now.
Can you help clarify what an acceptable use would be? Is a building okay if it's a horse arena, like we've heard in the county, or is it not okay if someone stores something like vintage cars there?
That's a question we haven't faced yet. What we identified last night, I think as much as anything else, was that we needed to go back and look at those uses, because some of those uses, matter of fact, maybe all of those uses that you've just referred to, may come with unlimited size buildings, because they are not accessory uses. Those are uses that are conditional uses, or even allowed uses within the zone. And again, we've just got to go back and look at the uses, because use drives impacts, right? That's I think one of the things we recognized that we needed to do.
Can we touch on architecture real quick? Because I know, especially in a community and environment like here in the Wasatch Back, the way a building looks has a lot to do with how people perceive it. How does architecture fit into this puzzle?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't fit. We currently have some architectural requirements in our code that dates back, probably to the last significant revision, maybe a decade or two. But those there is a question about whether those code issues can be enforced, and certainly the entire notion of tightening up architectural control to make the buildings look more compatible with, you know, our vision of an agrarian area, it has been precluded by the legislature. So we do not get to control architecture in single-family dwellings or related structures.
Right. And earlier in the summer, the county council changed the TZO so it does not apply to smaller accessory buildings. Does that make any difference at all here?
This was just to clean that up, right? And the TZO, the revision of the TZO, was just to eliminate the choke point that we had put in place for a lot of those permits. That is to say, you know, the large majority of those permits are not for, you know, 20,000 square foot or 40,000 square foot riding arenas. They're for much smaller buildings. And so in order to try and gain ourselves a little time, we allowed for, I believe it was buildings up to 5,000 square feet. And that took the pressure off, essentially. As I noted, that was the day that I stopped getting emails, and I think generally people have been able to get permits without too much difficulty during that period of time.
So would you say that remedy did work? I know after 6 months, the council struggled to come to a decision on this.
Well, I think, again, the remedy was short-term. It was to get people out of the short-term bind of not being able to get a permit for, let's call it, a more typical outbuilding. What we're focusing on are the the very large structures, and it would appear based on what we were handed from the legislature last year that our ability to control that virtually is limited by bulk and mass. That is to say, how tall is the building? You know, how big is it in three dimensions? And if that is our only control, I think the general feeling was that then we need to control size as reasonably as we can in order to minimize the impacts.
And taking a look at some other topics, in public comment you heard from several people who are vehemently against any mask health order in the county. They said everything's about politics, not the data, and the county's health directive is not constitutional. One speaker said she even had 100 signatures on a petition. After 15, 16 months of this, what is your reaction to that?
It's the whole pandemic has been punctuated by those sorts of opinions. We all know them. We probably don't come in contact with them very often, but we know that they're out there. And you know, they range the full gambit of that you can possibly imagine. We heard about illegal trading of birth certificates last night, which was not it wasn't clear how that was associated with our government. We don't do birth certificates. We don't do anything about that. But it was one of the things we heard about. And that's just part of what we've been involved in. That's part of the public process, and it's part of, unfortunately, it's part of the misinformation that this whole pandemic has been plagued with.
And in recent days, with the pandemic still kind of ramping up, unfortunately, here in Utah, what have you seen of people wearing masks or not wearing masks around the area, especially in indoor spaces?
Yeah, the guidelines from the feds are that if you're indoors with, you know, essentially people you don't know, you should wear a mask, whether you're vaccinated or not. Our infection rate in the county is very low, relatively low. So we don't have any policies at this point that would require people to wear masks. I think this is, you know, as we go through this is going to be more like what we experienced in the past. We have to get a plan together that is going to show the world that we have a safe and efficient operation going forward and as we go into the winter season. And that'll take the cooperation of everybody. We'll have to figure out what that looks like.
And there was also a lengthy presentation with the Friends of Summit County Search and Rescue. Did they have a request for counsel yesterday?
Yes, they have some. They have some relatively significant equipment needs. Search and Rescue. We have an enormous county when it comes to search and rescue. Most of us think of the county as ending in Colville, but it backs up two-thirds of the way to the state line, and we have enormous mountainous terrain that we are called upon to serve, and winter or summer, it just takes special equipment. And so, yes, that was, they had a request in for the budget for, their big ticket item was a new snowcat.
So would you say the council is receptive about giving them more funding for next year's budget?
The budgeting process is coming up. Certainly among our priorities would be to properly fund these people. As usual, their request will get aggregated with every other department. So remains to be seen, but obviously we're very supportive of search and rescue.
All right. Anything else you want to touch on, Doug, before we let you go?
I think that's it. Thank you.
Great. Well, that is Summit County Council Member Doug Clyde with a recap of last night's meeting. Doug, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, taking a look at local news before our next guest, the Camas Planning Commission hosted a public hearing Tuesday night on whether to allow nightly rentals in town, and only one resident turned out to speak. The planning commissioners continued the item to get more information, saying they will face challenges no matter what course they take. Rick Bruff has more.
The chair of the Camas Planning Commission, Leslie Staples, said that, like it or not, nightly rentals have come to town. City planner Amanda Huffmeyer asked the Planning Commission to discuss whether nightly rentals should be allowed, if so, where they should be located, and what kind of permitting process they should follow. The only comment in the public hearing came from Jessica Allen Bateman, a Camas resident for over 20 years, who said the city doesn't need nightly rentals.
I don't want a party next to me. I don't want the irresponsibility of tenants, which I've seen many, many, many times. And I don't think the town set up for it needs it.
Huffmeyer said she drafted an ordinance to regulate nightly rentals, mixing together statutes from Part City and Midway. She said she could also look at communities that have banned them. Planning commissioner said whether nightly rentals were banned or permitted, they will have to find a way to enforce their decision. Planning Commissioner Nathan Miles said the topic brings up a familiar dilemma.
Now we're back to the dilemma that we've had in years past, and we'll be willing to tell landowners what they can do or not do with their property.
Staples said it's clear that the nightly rentals can be lucrative.
We had a client over in Park City that rented her house for the Christmas New Year holiday. That's how she supplemented her income and didn't have to work for 6 months because she just rented her house for a 2-week period of time and moved out. So, I mean, people definitely make money that way.
She said her concern is people will figure a way to get around the system, and Staples added, quote, "Do I love it? No." Planning Commission voted unanimously to table the topic. Staples said in the end it won't be an easy decision for any of them. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, last month, Save People, Save Wildlife signed their fourth contract with the Utah Department of Transportation to build an additional mile of wildlife fencing along Interstate 80, bringing our state closer to closing the gap between the wildlife overpass at Parley Summit and Kimball Junction. Joining me now, we have the Save People, Save Wildlife Secretary Aaron Ferguson and Gabby Saunders to talk about their efforts to prevent wildlife vehicle collisions on I-80, their recent fundraising successes, and what's next on their radar. Aaron and Gabby, good morning.
Good morning, Sean. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Aaron, let's start with you. You've been involved with Save People, Save Wildlife since the beginning. Why don't you give our listeners a summary of how the group started their efforts, the evolution in creating the wildlife overpass on Parley Summit, and now where things stand on the fencing needed to really finish off this project?
Oh, thank you, Sean. Yes, a group of neighbors basically got together in 2015 and said something needs to be done. There are too many animals dying on the freeway, just, you know, over the ridge from our neighborhood. And so we started some basic public awareness things, you know, let's have a newscaster interview us, newspaper articles, et cetera. And then once the Jersey barricades were installed by the Wileman School up towards Parley Summit on the east side of I-80, it just became a gauntlet of death. And so we lost 12 moose in 10 days, and finally we said, enough's enough. We've got to take a stand. And so we approached the governor's office, et cetera. We did some grassroots things to get the attention of the public and of course, UDOT. And that's the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So here we are. We have our first mile of fencing went in 2016. And then it's just evolved from there a mile at a time. And, of course, the overpass in 2018. So what we need to do is finish closing these gaps because the animals will just walk the fencing, get to where it is not wildlife fencing, and just get on the freeway and then, the consequences of that. So that's what we're working on right now is finishing I-80. Because now we're at the point where Kimball Junction towards Swanner Preserve needs to be fenced and then provide safe crossing for them across the freeway back and forth for migratory purposes.
And can you talk about the animals that you know have used the bridge? I know there was video available that was compiled by the DWR, but I understand that's no longer available.
Well, it's an effort. It's not it's constant camera rolling. So every so often, UDOT and DWR get together and edit the video footage. So it takes many hours to edit and compile sequences of animals using the bridge. You know, so it's not a highly trafficked bridge as the video tends to imply. That is a compilation of many months of footage of animals using the bridge. So it does take a lot of man hours and staff, you know, for UDWR and as well as UDOT to compile these video montages. So that's why we're not seeing a recent compilation, is because it's been a few months. They're working on editing the latest sequence of Animal Crossings. So once that is edited and compiled and posted on their sites, then we'll be able to share via social media, et cetera.
And how much more of fencing is needed to actually finish off this project, and what kind of funding would be required to complete a project like this?
Well, just the fencing alone, approximately $100,000 per mile. So we have about, a little between 4 and 5 miles to go from Kimball Junction to Silver Creek Junction, and also extend just past that interchange towards I-80, where the wildlife fencing already exists, and then also, get that continuous fencing on finished on Highway 40, where it meets 80 there at the Silver Creek Junction. So all in all, that's just the fencing alone. So, it would effectively be 8+ miles of fencing, because you have to do both sides of the freeway, right? And then cattle guards at appropriate on and off ramps so the animals can't access the freeway via those. And then also provide alternatives for safe crossings. You can do underpasses, overpasses, but something needs to be provided for them so we're not isolating these animals with fencing. So the three components have to be in place for it to be effective. Otherwise, fencing alone won't work, cattle guards alone won't work, an overpass alone won't work because they're not guided to the safe crossing. They'll just cross where they're used to crossing. So all three components need to be in place for it to be fully effective.
Yeah, and is there data to compare wildlife collisions before and after the fencing and bridge on I-80 were installed?
It's a little misconstrued because so many large mammals were killed just before the overpass went in. So the data may, there's definitely a difference. I'm not sure what exact percentages are, but I know in 2011 when they put the wildlife fencing in from like the Mountain Dell area up towards Parley Summit, that decreased wildlife vehicle collisions by over 70% in just a matter of months. So it is marked improvement, and that's just with fencing. They already had the cattle guards in place at Lambs and East Canyon exits. So, just the fencing alone made that marked difference. So yes, it is very effective. And then also with the recent wildfire on that south side of I-80, I'm glad that the overpass was there, gave the animals a viable option to cross over to that north side of I-80 safely.
Mm. KBCW did report on the hotspot study done a couple of years ago, and 6 out of the top 10 were all located in Summit and Wasatch counties. Why is this region in particular so deadly for wildlife?
So, Aaron, do you mind if I speak to that one?
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Gabby, please.
So part of the reason that we see those areas being so deadly is the fact that they are migration corridors for a lot of the large ungulates that we do see in Utah. So when fall rolls around, which is when we all know we start seeing more of the carcasses on the road, what's happening is a lot of the deer, elk, moose, they're moving from their summer ranges into their winter ranges. And obviously roads do create that barrier for them, and being in a rural area with a lot of migration corridors, whether it's Heber, whether it's Park City, and whether it's Camas, those areas do tend to be affected by it because we're right in the pathway of their migration. And large ungulates like that, they don't necessarily adapt the way they move with their migration corridors, because those are patterns that have been ingrained in them for thousands and hundreds of years. A really good example of that, there's actually a hotel in Zambia that ended up building a hotel right in the middle of an elephant migration corridor. And every year, like clockwork, the elephants don't go around the hotel, they go through it. every year. And so we see similar things with elk, deer, moose, things of that nature. And that's why it tends to be a little bit more deadly up in the Summit Wasatch areas.
Very interesting. So, Gabby, you are the new to the organization and just released a press statement last month about another UDOT contract to build another mile of wildlife fencing. We talked about some of the money for that already, but what is the timing on this fencing project?
So it really is dependent on how much money we can get and how quickly we can get it. As Aaron alluded to earlier, it takes about $100,000 for every mile of fencing. And I know this last check, correct me if I'm wrong, Aaron, but it was about $42,000 grand total between the two checks we submitted to UDOT, and they matched that. So it's that slow build of how quickly can we get the money. So we do have a really amazing opportunity coming up to help speed that along with that press release. I know it mentioned that there was a resolution 2021-10 that will be on the ballot this November for Summit County voters, and that is essentially to allow a bond to be issued not to exceed $50 million. And there will be money earmarked for open space conservation easements and the construction of recreational amenities and environmental and wildlife mitigation measures. So that's one of those opportunities, if that were to pass through on the ballot, that we could work with the Summit County Council to get that earmarked to speed along the process of doing the wildlife fencing. And obviously, we're going to continue doing community efforts of fundraising, because I think we have seen with our past efforts that this is something that Summit County residents do really care about, and they are willing to put their money where their mouth is. And I think if we continue that momentum, it will continue to signal to city, county, and state level governments that we do need funding for this. And it does work, and it is something that we're all excited and happy about as a community.
You mentioned the Summit County Council. They will be running a $50 million open space and recreation bond. And does that include wildlife preservation? Is that part of that bond?
Yep. So it's open space conservation easements. And the big part of it, which does play into helping us build more wildlife crossings, is part of it is earmarked for the wildlife mitigation measures. So that can be fencing, that can be additional crossings, that can be cattle guards. It's just something to be determined if it is passed and what we are able to do working with the Summit County Council come its passage.
And Gabby, you did mention some data about mule deer crossing the highway in the Chalk Creek and Camas areas. Is that a DWR project to collar the mule deer, or is that something different?
Yes, so that is a UDWR project. The Camas Chalk Creek area, if memory serves me correctly, that was predominantly to do a study under Order 3362, and that came from the Department of the Interior under the Trump administration, and it was an initiative to start preserving big game corridors all throughout the western United States. So under that order, that's where that study came from, but DWR is also working on plotting the migration movements of hundreds and thousands of animals throughout the state of Utah currently. Right now, they have close to 7,000 animals collared, tracking their locations, and it's everything from big animals to avian species to reptiles to toads. And by tracking that data, they can give us a better idea, along with Patty Kramer's hotspot report that you mentioned earlier, to help us identify where these major needs are for these wildlife crossings and these mitigation measures.
And Aaron, maybe you want to take this one, but what are the plans for future fundraising projects? What do you see as the top two or three priorities in Summit and Wasatch counties over the next few years?
Well, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, right? We want to do it right. And then once the mitigation measures are in place, we'd like to finish I-80. And then, of course, once a hotspot is addressed based on Dr. Kramer's report, then that hotspot has been resolved, in effect. So the next hotspot moves up to the top of the list. So it is kind of an evolutionary process, and as we make headway with one area, we can tie a bow on that, maintain it moving forward, migration corridors are restored, and then we can move on to the next area of concern. So I think that you know, it's about education right now, because while these studies are underway, while these efforts of, you know, construction and migratory corridor restoration are happening, we need to educate these new residents that have moved into the Park City area. You know, school just started. We have new drivers on the roads. You know, they may or may not be savvy to hours of high wildlife activity and what to watch for on the roads and be respectful of the speed limit and things like that. You know, just basic things that we, you know, motor safety is a huge concern. And as a result, wildlife are saved if motorists are safer. So it's all in conjunction. So kind of a broad answer to your specific question, but, you know, we would certainly like to get I-80 addressed and have that up and running in a functional, effective manner, and then look at the immediate concerns of 224, 248, you know, I-80 by ECHO, for example, you know, things like that, and just do one thing at a time, get these areas addressed, and basically check hotspots off the list.
And if I may add, another huge part of that process is doing standalone wildlife crossing projects is exponentially more expensive than working it in with projects that UDOT already has planned for road restoration or adding in, you know, an intersection or whatever it may be. So part of this process is not only collecting the data, but also working in timing with UDOT appropriately, that when they do have a project coming up, that we can tack on these wildlife mitigation measures if and when we do have the funds available. So that will also determine what areas get tapped first. So it, as Aaron said, it is an evolutionary process, and it's just a matter of us being able to raise funds and also having these collaborative relationships with UDOT, DWR, and other partners to ensure that these projects move forward when they have the opportunity to do them.
Sounds great. So, Gabby, is there anything else you think is important to know about Save People, Save Wildlife's efforts, and how can people get involved if they want to help out?
So, as Aaron said, our biggest goal is education and awareness, aside from making sure these crossings and other mitigation measures come into place. So one of the things we are working on is collecting stories of residents that have dealt with wildlife vehicle collisions so we can start elevating those voices. And another part of that is, again, putting your money where your mouth is. Any dollar we get, it goes to these projects when they do come up. And obviously a lot of that money right now is going to be going to completing the fencing on I-80. But once that's complete, we do expect to expand to working on more projects. So the best way to get involved is to share your story and also donate. And the best place to do that would be on our website at SavePeopleSaveWildlife.org.
Well, Gabby and Aaron, thank you both so much for your time. It was fascinating to hear about this.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having us.
That is Save People, Save Wildlife Secretary Aaron Ferguson and Gabby Saunders. Well, the U Sports Alliance will be holding their annual Jan's Winter Welcome coming up next month, as well as a bunch of other things happening this fall. To talk all about that, joining me in the studio now is Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
So what can we expect this fall? We had Winter Welcome virtual last year. How did that go?
Yeah, last year we launched our virtual campaign in June, and it ended up being better than we thought. Our supporters and donors really stepped up to the plate, and we were able to raise the same amount of money that we've made in the past. So that was great. Our virtual campaign was very successful. We worked with our seven partner clubs and did a great job to make sure that we could provide the same amount of funding that we've provided in the past.
And we're going to be back in person, at least right now, this year, October 23rd at the Stein Erickson. What can we expect this year?
Yeah, this year we are planning to have the event as normal. It's October 23rd at Stein Erickson Lodge. Stein's has always been a great partner of ours, and we will make sure that we follow all of the local and state mandates that are in place. But we're looking forward to having that in person and excited to be back in person.
Are you selling fewer tickets maybe at all this year to spread people out a little bit more? Is it at full capacity?
You know, we're still looking at all of those pieces and parts. It's still quite a few weeks away. So we just want to monitor what's happening in the community and do the responsible thing. And we'll just sort of continue to look at that and make sure that we can run a safe and fun event.
If things take a turn for the worse, is there a contingency plan for
Yeah, you know, online? It's such a different environment than it's been in the past. And I think the legacy of the last year is that we've all become more flexible. We've all learned to pivot and figure out how to do things differently. And so we have a plan A, which is running the event as usual, that we hope we'll be able to do. And then we have a plan B and C and D and E. So we'll see how it goes.
How much of a challenge is it to retool from an in-person event to a virtual event? Or after last year, do you guys kind of have it down pat?
Yeah, again, I mean, I think last year was a little bit easier because it was sort of black and white what we could do and what we couldn't do. This year, we're definitely seeing more gray areas. But like I said, I think, you know, one of the things that really has come out of the last year is we've become more flexible, and we have such great support from our board, from our community, from the 7 member clubs that we know we'll be able to figure out a great answer, and we're excited to do that.
So let's talk about some of the, I guess, prizes available at Jan's Winter Welcome. Seeing an all-inclusive 3-night stay at a guest ranch, and other things. What can people spend their money on?
Yeah, one of the things we do each year at a Jan's Winter Welcome is we, as the Youth Sports Alliance, provide an opportunity drawing item. And so this year, it's a 3-night all-inclusive stay at the Alisal Dude Ranch, which is outside of Santa Barbara. It's really a luxury, wonderful place to go. So what we do every year is we provide that opportunity drawing item, and then the 7 member clubs and the Youth Sports Alliance sell those tickets, and the ticket sales go back to those clubs at 100%. So if you want to support a specific club, a specific athlete, you can do that online, just ysaparkcity.org. You can find those opportunity drawing tickets. So it's one way that we provide a platform for those clubs to raise funds for their clubs in whatever way they deem necessary. And so you can buy those tickets and support those clubs and those athletes.
I'm sure people are very excited to see this back on the calendars. Let's talk a little bit about the after-school programming. I understand that begins this Friday for 14 schools across Summit and Wasatch counties.
Yeah, so school has started, and that means our after-school programs are back. Get out and play for our elementary school kids, and then activate for our middle school and junior high kids. We are now, in 14 schools. We're excited about that. We'll have 132 kids starting programs on Friday, mountain biking, sailing, rowing, and then a whole variety of things at our partner, Woodward Park City.
And let's talk about some of these scholarships. I see 17 students received scholarships for September programming. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think the important thing to know about our after-school programming is we do provide scholarships. We provide scholarships for any student who is on free and reduced lunch. They pay a small commitment fee. What we started last year is we also have a Tier 2 scholarship program. So for any families that are making under $100,000 a year, we provide scholarships as well. So if you don't qualify for free and reduced lunch, but you make less than $100,000 annually, you pay about half of what the normal rate is. So we saw that those families making less than $100,000 were participating the least in our program, so we wanted to make sure that any student out there that wants to participate or try something new has the opportunity to do so.
And we just talked about the after-school programs with the biking, sailing, rowing, being at Woodward, but ski season is fast approaching, and I understand that registration for those programs will begin next month.
Yeah, so we work with our local partner resorts, and we're still trying to figure out exactly how the ski season is going to look. And once we figure out that, then we will have our registration up and live. It's about mid-October is what we're targeting. And you can find information on all of our after-school programs on ysaparkcity.org.
This winter is also leading up to the next Olympic Games in Beijing, China. Can you talk a little bit about Youth Sports Alliance's relationships with local Olympians and how they're approaching this winter?
Yeah, so we love our local Olympians here in Park City and Youth Sports Alliance. We like to track how many of those make it to the Olympic Games. So in 2014, we started tracking all of the Park City Olympians. So we called it Park City Nation. In 2014, if Park City had participated as their own nation, they would have finished, I think, 10th in the Olympic in the medal count, which is tied with Switzerland. In 2018, we finished 20th, which was tied with Australia. So we'll start tracking those athletes. Right now, there are 52 athletes that have come out of those seven winter sport clubs or have ties to Park City. They live here or they grew up here. So 52 athletes were named from their national governing bodies to national or junior national teams. So exciting to track those athletes, see who make it to the Olympics. 29% of those athletes started in our program, Get Out and Play. So we're kind of have our fingers crossed that maybe we'll get our first Olympian that started and Get Out and Play.
Awesome. Sounds fantastic. Lots of Olympic heritage here in Park City. Let's talk a little bit about the Park City Nation and Olympic Paralympic athlete delegation. What is this program?
So that's what I was saying, is that we just track those athletes that come out of Park City, and we call them Park City Nation, and then we kind of track how Park City Nation does at the Olympic Games, just to give locals somebody extra to root for, and they know exactly who coming out of this community or out of our seven winter clubs is competing at the Olympic Games. We also, seven of those athletes who are were named to the national or junior national teams have received direct funding from our Stein Erickson Endowment Fund. So it's exciting to see that those scholarship dollars that were raised right here in this community are providing Olympic opportunities for locals' youth. So exciting.
Very exciting. And I understand planning is already underway for the Olympic and Paralympic homecoming parade next year. When can we expect that, and what would this parade look like?
Yeah, so every year, every 4 years, the Youth Sports Alliance organizes and puts on the Olympic and Paralympic homecoming parade. So that's for any of our local Olympians, but we also invite any Olympian who lives in the area to come march in that parade. So it's really fun to see, we have Eric Heiden, we have, we'll have Bill DeMong, hopefully we'll have Ted Ligety. They all come and parade down and just celebrate our Olympic heritage. We are looking to try to finalize that date. Obviously, there's a lot of calendars, a lot of different sports, a lot of different things happening, but usually that happens in the springtime. So we'll have that event, and it's just always a really fun, I think it's one of my favorite local events, just to celebrate all of the local athletes, the clubs, and all of the resorts and companies that support our efforts.
Wonderful. Anything else you want to share with us this morning, Emily?
No, I think just that everybody can find information on our opportunity drawing, on Giants Winter Welcome, and our after-school programs on ysaparkcity.org.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. That's Emily Fisher with the Youth Sports Alliance. She's executive director there. Jan's Winter Welcome is scheduled for October 23rd at the Stein Erickson Lodge. You can purchase event tickets or opportunity drawing tickets at ysaparkcity.org. Well, the Mountain West region saw more than 80 armed protests over the last year and a half. A new analysis warns these events are more likely to turn violent compared to unarmed demonstrations. Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent has this.
The Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project shows our region hosted only about 6% of the nation's protests, but we saw 15% of the country's armed demonstrations. They were typically at the hands of far-right groups in response to protests against things like police violence and racial injustice. Rutabe Kishi is with the nonprofit. It focuses on global political violence.
So you can see how armed demonstrations are really disproportionately represented in the region. And it's not, I guess, terribly surprising, given that we see armed demonstrations are 5 times more common in open carry states.
Many of the armed protests in the West were at state capitals, and Kishi says that could intimidate lawmakers and affect what policies they're willing to enact. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Robin Vincent.